This is the Digital Savage Experience Podcast, hosted by Roman Prokopchuk, bringing you all things digital marketing, tech, business, and motivation. What's stopping you from becoming relentless in all aspects of life? Are you ready to become a digital savage? Let's get into today's episode.
Hey everyone, this is Roman Prokopchuk, and this is the Digital Savage Experience Podcast. Today I have with me Robert Kerbeck. Robert is a former corporate spy and the author of Ruse. Thank you for joining me today.
Hey Roman, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So tell me a little bit about your journey. Obviously, that's kind of an interesting role to be in. So how did you kind of get into that? You know, where did you kind of get started? What's your journey to now?
Yeah, I saw a job posting for corporate spy and I signed up, right? No, you know, there's no such thing as a job posting for a corporate spy. You know, my hometown is Philadelphia, Fly Eagles Fly. And my family, the Kerbeck family, is very well known in the automobile business. My great grandfather sold horse carriages before cars were invented. He became one of the first car dealers in Philadelphia. My grandfather took over that dealership. My father took it over. I was supposed to take it over. But in college, I got really into acting, wanted to move to New York to try to be an actor, but it just seemed insane to me. So I went to work for my dad and was selling cars, but it just didn't feel right to me. Kind of the trickery of car sales, it just didn't sit right with me. So eventually I got the courage. I moved to New York to be an actor. Of course, actors need survival jobs to pay the bills. And who stumbles into a career as a corporate spy? But that's what I did.
How did that kind of come about?
You know, a buddy of mine, I only knew one person in New York, a buddy of mine, and he had this job. He mentioned it very briefly, and then he shut up right away. Like he knew he said something he wasn't supposed to say. He knew he wasn't supposed to talk about it. And all of a sudden, he just shut up. And I said, whoa, dude, I'm broke. You know, you got to help me out. I need a job. So very kind of hesitantly, he got me an interview, and I go up to this basically woman's place on the Upper East Side. For your listeners that maybe don't know Manhattan, but the Upper East Side is kind of like the ritziest part of Manhattan. It's old money. So I go up. There's a doorman building. I was living in a cave in Hell's Kitchen. I go up to the penthouse. This woman opens the door and ushers me into the nicest apartment I'd ever seen. So right away, I knew whatever this woman did, it was lucrative. And had this very strange interview. She never asked me any questions about my skill. She never tells me anything about the job. Sends me on my way. My buddy calls me later and says, you got the job, but don't get too excited because no one is able to do this job. And the next day, I went out to Brooklyn. To this rundown, you know, dilapidated, you know, this is the old days, Brooklyn, you know, before hipsters with beards and coffee shops. This is like crack epidemic Brooklyn. And go into this, on this time, I walk up four, you know, flights of stairs. I knock on a door. This attractive woman opens the door, says, come on in, you'll work in my bedroom. And I was like, what the heck have I got myself into? But I was single at the time. So, hey, I went into her bedroom. And she sits me down at her desk and says, you probably don't know what we do, but we use our acting skills to call major corporations and get people to tell us secrets and private information, things that they should never, ever tell us in a million years. And that was my beginning as an apprentice, you know, my apprenticeship as a corporate spy.
And how long did you end up doing that?
For a long time, you know, for many years. It was just, you know, a survival job because, you know, I was a working actor. You know, I was, you know, drinking beers with Paul Newman and getting hit on by Kevin Spacey and dancing in an exercise video with O.J. Simpson the week before he became the world's most famous double murderer. So I was working as an actor and I was doing plays with James Gandolfini and so it was just a survival job, and that's kind of how I rationalized it, even though I knew I was lying and deceiving people to get information. And then all of a sudden there was a point, and I talk about this in my book, Ruse, where I went really deep into the world of corporate espionage, and at one point was being chased by, you know, pretty much every authority in America because they thought I was the world's most famous hacker, and they thought that I was trying to shut down the internet, which had just kind of become commercially accessible in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I think, corporate espionage in general, like from what like I know of it or in general, it's been a lot talked about in terms of China. So like Chinese agents come over here and kind of infiltrate companies on site and steal like, you know, trade secrets and that kind of thing, and then bring them back and, you know, replicate things, damage our economy. So that was, you know, the only kind of window into that world that I had up until this conversation.
Right. So we all know the Russians spy on the Chinese, the Chinese spy on us. But what most people are shocked to find out, you know, is that major corporations are spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year to spy on each other, to steal that information from each other. And to do that, they hire spies. Now, of course, they hire spies through an intermediary. You know, often they because, you know, they want to have plausible deniability that if they hire me, you know, and obviously I'm not spying anymore. I wouldn't be a very good spy if I wrote a book about spying and outed myself if I was still spying, right? But they want to have plausible deniability that they can say, oh, we had no idea what Robert was doing. And so a lot of times the spying is done through consulting firms that corporations hire. The consulting firm will hire the spying firm through an executive recruiting firm. The executive recruiting firm hires spies. But that's a way that they do it so that they basically don't get caught. But I'm here to tell you, I've presented, you know, extracted data, stolen data to multiple individuals that today are one step from being the CEO of some of the largest corporations in the world. And these are individuals that are on CNBC talking about culture and ethics and all of these things. And yet they are loving when they get data that has been stolen from their competitors, because it gives them a leg up, because these corporations are incredibly cutthroat. You know, you think about football teams and basketball teams, how competitive it is. It's the same thing in corporate America, maybe even more so. And a firm that's number seven in the rankings, a CEO that's the, you know, the CEO of the seventh ranked firm, he's not going to keep his job, or she's not going to keep, you know, her job very long if she remains number seven. She needs to be number one. She needs to be number two. Well, how do you do that? Well, you find out what the number one firm is doing. You find out what the number two firm is doing. You find out who the people are at their firm that are the rock stars, and you steal those people, and you steal the secrets that they hold, or you find out the secrets through the spies, what the products in the pipeline are, what their pricing looks like, who their clients are, you know, are they expanding, you know, where are they expanding, you know, anything and everything that a corporation can use to get a tactical advantage on their competitor.
Now, it's obviously more of a victimless crime per se. Have you, during that time, have you ever felt like any kind of guilt, you know, regret throughout the process?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I reckon with that, you know, that's a big part of the book where I'm going, you know, what have I gotten myself into? How do I feel about that? And then how do I get myself out of it? You know, because once you get into it, and certainly later in the career, you know, I went from making $8 an hour to making $2 million a year, right? You know, in terms of victimless crime, I mean, that's kind of how we rationalized a lot of it. Because, you know, some of the information that we were getting was using to get people better jobs. So we were like, well, look, you know, the rock stars at firm A are getting recruited by firm B, and they're going to get a huge raise. How could that be bad? Isn't that part of the capitalist system? But we were also deceiving people. And I never felt good about that. So, you know, that was something that, you know, I reckoned with. And there was a certain point where I just said, I can't do this anymore. And I had to get out. And that was kind of when I had the proverbial midlife crisis. And at that point, I kind of circled back. I'd been an English major in college, and I started writing and started getting published as a writer. I hadn't thought about really having a career as a writer, you know, since I was a young guy. And at one point I was at a writer's conference, and I wrote something about this world of corporate spying, never thinking about it being a book. And of course, the people there flipped out. They said, wow, we didn't know this world existed. You got to write about this, because people are going to be fascinated to see how competitive it is, how much money is at stake, how, you know, endemic corporate spying is to that, to our world. And so then I started writing this book, Ruse, and I've been really, pleased with the response. One of the first things, you know, when you write a book, your publisher, you know, sends it out to people to ask them to read it and consider giving a testimonial, so to speak. And one of the people they sent it to was Frank Abagnale, who wrote Catch Me If You Can. And he flipped over the book, and he gave me this amazing blurb, which they put on the cover of the book. And then, of course, when Frank Abagnale, you know, who wrote Catch Me If You Can, which, of course, became a really super successful movie, when he says something good, the ears pricked up of the people in Hollywood. And now Ruse is in development for a TV series, which, of course, again, I never, ever expected something like that to happen. So, it just shows you for your listeners out there, you know, if you want to pivot to a new career, it's never too late to pivot to a new career, you know, and I always tell people, you know, take the journey that you want to take, you know, and so here I am late in life. All of a sudden I start writing books and, you know, look what happened. I never, ever would have expected things like this to happen, but I'm glad that they are.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose all of that, it was really a creative endeavor. Obviously, the acting helped you, I guess, be that. And how did you kind of go about that? Were you kind of like, you know, presented information and then you were put on a persona that would fit and make sense for that specific situation or scenario that you were dealing with?
Yeah, this is Gerhard calling from the office in Frankfurt, Germany. We have the European Union regulators and we need some information from the States. Right. So the acting skills right there. Right. We would put on accents, voices, and we would utilize those to get people to be comfortable and believe. Because, look, corporations have offices all over the world right now. You could be in the Frankfurt office. You could be in the Dublin office. You could be in the Tokyo office. You could be in the London office. You could be in the Atlanta office. Right. You could be anywhere. And they would go, I recognize that name, Gerhard. He runs compliance in Frankfurt. Oh, he's meeting with the regulators. Oh boy, this must be an emergency. I better help this guy out, right? Because people in America, and I mean, for, you know, people in the corporate world globally are taught to be what? A good teammate, right? And so, you know, we're all on the same team for XYZ Corporation. So if somebody's jammed up, if there's some crisis, if there's some emergency, I have to help them out. Even though my requests made no sense whatsoever in terms of why would this guy in Germany need information on my team in New York City or need information on my team in Palo Alto or wherever, right? But it just doesn't make sense. But at the same time, it's counterintuitive. But the crazier the request, the more outlandish the request, a lot of times the more believable it became.
Yeah, that makes sense. And with companies with, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees, you know, tens of thousands of employees, it can get really lost in the mix. Or if you find information about someone in a different company, country or office, like you mentioned, that they may have never dealt with, it's somewhat of an easy in if they kind of, you know, I've had situations where like people were very persuasive, you know, borderline like convincing me to do something. And, you know, when you're over the phone and you're like throwing things related to a company, that person's role, it becomes like more comfortable to, you know, divulge information or point you in the right direction.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, we would do a lot of research before we made a call. And what was fascinating was in the beginning when we first started doing the corporate spying, we would go in person, right? We would go to an event, we would go to a bar, whatever. But what we found is that through the anonymity of the phone call, we were able to get far more information than we were able to obtain in person. And of course, obviously, going in person was more dangerous in terms of getting caught, right? And so we began to realize that, you know, the phone call, you know, the social engineering phone call, or what I call the rusing phone call, you know, hence the title of the book, Ruse, is very powerful. And I'm here to tell you it's alive and well. You know, we think about in this world of texting and emailing and, you know, that people don't make phone calls anymore, and they certainly don't make as many phone calls, but still social engineers use the phone call all the time. And it's one of the big things now in terms of cybercrime and ransomware attacks, because a lot of times, and I speak about this a lot now, a lot of times the cyber criminals are utilizing, it's not just one person, they're teams of people, right? It's a couple of people. And each person usually has an expertise. So there's the hacking expert, there's the financial instruments expert, you know, because how are they going to get this money once they figure out, you know, they once they hack a system and they have a firm that they've had a successful attack, now they've got to figure out how are we getting this money that we're asking for, right? And how do we not get caught getting that money? So there's that expert. And there's also the social engineering expert. And that's usually the person that goes in first, asks a lot of questions, figures out things, gets information that then the hacker can then utilize to make the hacking so much easier. You know, I used to always say, I don't need to hack your system, because I can hack your people. And if I can get your people to tell me passwords, which I can, if I can get your people to tell me how your server is set up, which I can, it's so easy then to hack the system, right? You know, and that's the thing that's amazing, is the weakest link in cybersecurity is always the human being. And yet corporations spend a minuscule amount of time and money training their employees to not fall victim to social engineering, phone calls, phishing, et cetera, et cetera. They spend billions of dollars and soon trillions of dollars protecting their systems and servers, and very little time and money on training their employees.
Yeah, I think that's the reason I don't even pick up my phone anymore, other than it's somebody in my a phone book. If it's a foreign number, I'll wait for them to leave a voicemail, or just wait in general if they don't leave anything, because it's like at this point having a mindset like, if you're calling me, you're guilty until you're proven innocent, because it's like you.
And that's a great attitude to have. That's the attitude people should have, you know, but I'm here to tell you, I get you to pick up your phone.
I mean, I've been close to falling for different scams, I guess, in my life. So if you're persuasive enough, if you have good people skills and can, you know, put on an act, most people will divulge some kind of information, or like you said, you can probably get them on the phone. And when did you end up, how long ago did you end up kind of getting out of that?
It was like about a decade ago now. You know, that's kind of the statute of limitations. So, you know, that's part of why I had to wait to publish the book this year. I had to wait in case there were any crimes that I'd committed. So that's the timing.
Now, were you ever close to, you know, being afraid of getting caught and potentially, you know, going away? Like, you know, was that one of the reasons you stopped, or it was just one of those things that, you know, I can't do this anymore?
Well, what happened was, and there were a number of close calls, there were a couple of close calls where basically, you know, my buddy that got me the job, you know, I mentioned him originally in the book, his name is Pax. And Pax and I were being hunted by the FBI, the Secret Service, the U.S. Marshals. And they were after this guy that was, known as the world's most famous hacker. And then they stumbled on our trail. And in the beginning, we thought, you know, when we first started doing this job, we met with an attorney because, you know, we were concerned about the legality of the job. And the attorney said, it's in the gray, the very dark gray. And so we were like, well, you know, he didn't say it was illegal, you know, and then of course we are getting, phone calls from the FBI. They're coming to our apartments. You know, they're basically telling us to come outside with our hands up. And when that happened, we realized maybe we had misjudged, the risk of what we were doing. But the funny thing is when they finally did catch this guy they were after, who had been on the run, he'd been on the lam, he had escaped from everyone, they couldn't find him. When they found him, what was fascinating is they were so busy patting themselves on the back that they got their man, it was front page in the New York Times, that they kind of just forgot about us. You know, they were like, well, we really weren't after them. We did find out that they were doing some pretty shady stuff, but we really only after this guy. We got this guy and they moved on. So we really got very lucky. When that happened, we began to make some changes to what we did to protect ourselves, but we still continued doing what we were doing. We just implemented some technology, and kind of made a couple of decisions to mitigate our risk, but we kept doing what we were doing. Because again, at that point, we were just actors and we needed money and that was our job, you know? So we were very lucky to, you know, escape without prison time.
Yeah. It's funny because I interned with the, a Secret Service when I was in, college, more so on the counterfeit currency side, but yeah, I mean, eventually when you feel kind of pressure in that sense of, you know, the law after you, but like you said, thinking about it, it's in a real gray area. If you spoke to an attorney, I mean, it's kind of like intel gathering, if you will. I guess you can like pad the words or use more politically correct words than espionage, just, you know, looking for additional info. In a court of law, you can mold it to where it's nicer and neater than, you know, you're stealing XYZ. It just, I mean, you can still obviously get in trouble for it. And obviously, like, you were being chased, but the way you could potentially spin it. And I mean, I can see someone that's in it telling themselves that too, like convincing themselves that they would, you know, continue it. I mean, I had people on the show that are like more cut and dry, like one of the founding members of the Medellin drug cartel. That's like cut and dry. You know, mm-hmm. they came to the realization they need to change that. Well, not most people end up leaving in a body bag, unfortunately, from that lifestyle. But, you know, they made a change. They knew what they were doing was detrimental and directly leading to, you know, death all around the world. And they chose to change. But, you know, when something is a little bit blurry in terms of the lines of morality, I mean, it can have you justify it for a longer period of time before getting out.
Right.
So
that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
And who's kind of your target audience for the book? Obviously, anybody could be interested in the story, but who do you like look, who is the reader you're looking to attract per se?
Well, you know, I like to describe, I think Ruse is two books in one, because there's the corporate spying, obviously, which apparently, you know, the reason that my publisher Penguin Random House bought the book was they said no one's ever written a book about corporate spying before. So there's a real audience for that, right? But because I was being an actor and I was working as an actor, I did like 50 major TV shows, Melrose Place, Star Trek, ER, NYPD Blue, all these shows in the 90s and 2000s. The book is kind of two books. So it kind of goes back and forth. So there's the Hollywood tell-all part of the book where you're on the set of the Exercise video with O.J. Simpson, which was subpoenaed in his trial. And you're seeing O.J. Simpson and what his behavior was like literally a week, 10 days before the murders. You know, you're interacting with George Clooney right before he gets famous. You're seeing Kevin Spacey attempt to molest me. You know, you're seeing all of this crazy stuff, but then you're also got the corporate spying part. So I think, you know, I wrote the book during COVID. You know, obviously COVID was a terrible time for the planet. And, so I wanted it to be fun. So it's a page turner. A couple of reviews said it reads like a spy novel, but everything in it is true. So I think anybody that likes, you know, Hollywood celebrities behind the scenes, but then also kind of the dark underbelly of corporate America with the espionage, you know, I think it's a cool combo.
No, that's awesome. And I think I say everything in life is a lesson or a blessing. Like out of that whole corporate espionage life, what were you able to take that's potentially like a positive, if you will?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I've had so many careers, you know, I was, you know, car sales, actor, you know, Miss Spy, writer, you know, I tell people all the time, I said it earlier, you know, take the journey you want to take, not the journey your dad wants you to take, your mom wants you to take, your partner wants you to take, your brother wants you to take, your boss wants you to take, you know, take the journey you want to take because life is short, you know? And so if any listeners are out there are looking to pivot to a career in corporate espionage, I'm here to tell you corporate spying is alive and well, booming business. The most shocking thing for me is I write the book gets published, I am inundated with emails and phone calls from corporations asking me to spy for them.
That's funny.
I know. And I'm like, guys, I outed myself. I cannot spy for you. I've put a target on my back. They're like, Robert, we loved your book. We need this information. Can you just do this one thing for us? I'm like, no, I can't. You know. So I'm telling you, listeners, there's a lot of work for corporate spies. If you want, reach out through my website, robertkerbeck.com, and I will guide you and tell you how to do it. I won't do it myself, but I'll tell you how to do it.
Yeah, I would think a corporation would reach out and, you know, contact you to, you know, potentially consult in terms of like, you know, warning signs, what to look out for, do more of like a corporate training, whereas they're just super blunt. Hey, can you get back into this and do this for us?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no, I have been doing what you just described, you know, doing kind of what we call penetration testing, because there's so many firms that are doing it with the technology and very few firms that are dealing with the human component, right? Like, hey, what can I get from people over the phone? Can I get somebody to give me their password? Yes. Can I get somebody to explain how the entire system and firewall and encryption and network? Yes. You know, can I get people to release all the information about salaries? Yes. Can I, you know, can I get people to tell me how employees are ranked within the firm? And again, your listeners may not know this. All corporations rank their employees. They have a ranking system that tells you who are the top people, who are not the top people, who are the valued people, who are what I call the rock stars. And so you can imagine if your competitor can find out who all the top people are at your firm, and now they're on the side recruiting those people, I'm getting all their cell phone numbers, and now you've just lost three or four of your top people. For a corporation, that can be devastating, you know, and especially for a small, medium-sized business. You lose some of your rock star people, you know, it takes you from being number one or two in an industry to now you're number seven in the industry because you just lost your best people and you didn't even know about it and they're gone, right? Yeah, that penetration testing to make sure that your employees are keeping their mouths closed is really important. Young people today, they've grown up in an era of digital transparency, and sometimes they don't understand how important keeping information private is. You know, a lot of times in my spine days, you know, I would use LinkedIn and I would see who were the new hires, who were the junior people that had just come out of college, they just had a job. So all of a sudden they're 3 months with the company, and they get this guy who's saying that he's the senior vice president of compliance in Germany or Europe or whatever. They're hesitant to say no. They don't want to make an enemy. And so now they're giving information they shouldn't give. And so, yeah, it's important corporations are utilizing penetration testing to really mitigate that. Especially now with ransomware, because now it's not just, oh, well, they told this secret they shouldn't have told. Oh, they gave up this information. You know, now it's your firm is shut down. You cannot operate. You know, I had a hospital recently. They had five facilities. They were shut down. They couldn't book an appointment. They couldn't have a doctor see a patient. Their systems were shut down. So think about how devastating that is.
Yeah, and they've, I mean, the hospitals I've heard, I think there was in the U.S., one of the states, Energy Grid, where they were forced to pay the ransom in Bitcoin or whatever crypto. So it's still even harder to catch them with that anonymity of crypto. So, I mean, right. it's tough. I mean, overall, so being kind of a good steward of that is important.
Yeah.
So yeah. What's one piece of advice you can leave with the audience, personal or professional?
Well, you know, in terms of, you know, we're talking a little bit now about cybercrime. You know, I always tell people when you get that phone call, text, email, that there's a sense of pressure. There's a sense of emergency. There's a sense of crisis. That's when you have to stop, right? Because that's what those things are trying to do. They're trying to get you to do something, to click on something, to open something before you've had time to think about it. Now, all of a sudden, you've gotten yourself in trouble, right? Somebody's now gained access to either your corporation's information or your personal information. And so that's, you know, kind of my big tip is that anytime something's saying, you know, you've been hacked, click on this thing right away, you know, you've got to, you know, I always say put the device down, walk away from the device, think about it, you know, talk to somebody, you know, because just 15 seconds, 30 seconds where you walk away and you reflect on it, you realize, oh, wait a second, boy, they almost got me. Boy, that looked really good. And so that would be the piece of advice I give to people.
Awesome. I appreciate you stopping by today. Can you let the audience know how they can find you or anything else you have going on?
Yeah, you know, I just tell people go to my website, robertkerbeck.com, K-E-R-B-E-C-K. You can buy Ruse from wherever you like to buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookshop. And you can also see the trailer for Ruse and get an idea of what the TV series is going to look like because it's posted up there on my website.
Awesome. Thanks again for stopping by.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This podcast has been brought to you by Nova Zora Digital. Find out how Nova Zora Digital can help your company grow online. Learn more at NovaZoraDigital.com. Until next time, all you digital savages.